Hey, Amanda, how you doing?
Hey!
Wow, it's such a lovely day today.
It's sunshiny and bright and crisp, and I'm so excited for this episode because we have the Godfather, Obi-Wan Kenobi, the king of California cuisine, the man, the myth, the legend.
Jonathan Waxman. Wow, what a guy.
I mean, this is just, we don't have enough time. There will never be enough time to hear all the stories from Jonathan Waxman, so stay tuned.
On this episode of On the Line with Daniel Holzman and Amanda Freitag, we will be talking to the inimitable Jonathan Waxman.
Welcome. Jonathan Waxman is here. I'm going to try to contain my excitement because I love this man dearly, as does the rest of the universe. Thank you, Jonathan, for being here. Welcome to what we call On the Line podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
I would invite you to everything every day if I could.
Thank you so much.
So we're going to talk a little bit about your illustrious career and things outside of your career as well. And Dan's going to intro you.
I've got a pre-prepared statement. Here on the line, I like to butter up our guests with a warm welcome and obsequious introduction. But there's nothing that I can say that could possibly live up to nor pay proper respect to the indelible mark that John Waxman has had on our industry and me personally. Even though you don't know me, you've deeply influenced my cooking in a profound way, which is extraordinary. I mean, I'm so grateful and honored to have the opportunity to learn from a man that is universally loved and respected, and he has made more of an influence on my personal cooking than perhaps any other chef, anybody that I've even actually worked for. Jonathan does not know me, but I know him. His cookbooks are fabulous. His food is effortlessly spectacular. His restaurants feel like the greatest dinner party that you wish you had ever been invited to, and he has mentored a myriad chefs along the way. And they all have wonderful things to say about him. The man worked alongside Alice Waters in the heyday of Chez Panisse and drove a blue Ferrari around Manhattan. Blue Ferraris, come on. So damn
red, cool. But we're not counting.
Fair enough. Who has a blue Ferrari? He's a chef's chef, a man you can still find working nightly on the line. The definition of a mensch. Thank you so much for everything you've done. And by the way, I got blood on the sheet. Last night, my friend was like, my kids are, you know, I'm staying at a friend's house, my godson's. And he's like, can we cook dinner together? And he brought cauliflower. He's like, oh, we'll roast some cauliflower. I was actually, you know, one of my favorite salads is this like shaved cauliflower salad. Completely didn't think about the fact that the first time I ate this salad, the first time I ever had cauliflower shaved like it was at Barbudo. It's like one of my favorite things to cook. It's so delicious. And I cut my finger on the mandolin last night. I bled all over the place. I'm not just blowing, you know, smoke up your ass. It really, so often I find myself cooking food that I tasted at your restaurant. It's just like no other person makes normal, simple food that you think should just, everybody's made before, and somehow it's special there. So thank you.
Well, that's kind of embarrassing, but thank you.
It's not embarrassing, man. It's really special. Thank you.
Dan bled for you. He bled for you.
I just imagine the shaved cauliflower with the red streaks in it.
Pretty much. Oh, embarrassing for me. It's not embarrassing for you. You cut yourself the back. You should be embarrassed, kid.
You did it at home, too. Did. You didn't do it in a commercial kitchen.
I had a glass of wine. I was bleeding for hours.
So this is something that everybody in New York City and around the country is talking about right now. Barbudo is celebrating its 20-year anniversary, and it is an establishment. It is a memory for everyone across the universe, and it is still a place where you go every day and spend some time in the kitchen, whether you like it or not.
Well, yeah. Part of that is necessity because, as we all know, that our industry was, you know, whacked on its ass with COVID. I think that, 2008 wasn't great for the industry. I think there's been a lot of you know, upheaval in every aspect of what restaurateurs have gone through for the last 10 years, 15 years. And I think it's becoming harder and harder to actually perform and have fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty much kind of my assessment of how things are in the restaurant business. But truthfully, I'm actually having more fun. And so it's somewhat contradictory that I'm, you know, enjoying my life at 73. You know, it's kind of, there's a famous restaurant in Paris called L'Ami Louis. And the owner recently died. I think he was in his early 90s, and he worked every day.
Every day.
And so that was sort of the inspiration for me to sort of never stop cooking. Because what are you going to do? I was, you know, Gordon Ramsay had a funny quote the other day. He says, you know, what am I, I'm going to stop doing what I do and sit on my butt in Bermuda and get tan? you know, you couldn't sit still for 1 second, that guy. But it really is true. I think that I do. So really the 20 years is kind of nonsensical because right. We were evicted. We lost our lease in 2019. And then I had another space in my back pocket, which I was going to reopen, which we did in 2020 for a grand total of 3 weeks. So I do count 2019 because we did 6 months then. And I'm sort of counting 2020 as a year, even though it was only 3 weeks. And then we reopened in October of 21. So in point of fact, we moved spaces, I changed my LLC, new partnership. So a lot of things happened in that time period. So having 20 years under my belt really actually feels like, you know, the end of a huge journey. It really does. And it was a fun journey. And I think I owe it so much to my staff.
Yes.
They're just remarkable in every way, shape, and form. My customers are remarkable human beings.
You're welcome.
You know? No, they really are. I was talking to my GM the other day, and he goes, you know, we're very lucky to have this amazing group of people that come to the restaurant, and they just seem to enjoy it. And we don't have – it's almost – it seems – on the face of it, effortless, mm-hmm. You know, on our part, but it's obviously not. But it actually brings, that's what brings the joy to me, seeing customers. And I have so many customers that come up and say, you know, congratulations, you know, thank you for being here, blah, blah, blah. It's kind of embarrassing. It really is, you know. I think a lot of the reason I got into the restaurant business as a chef is that I hated going to parties because I'm so shy that I hated it. I hated having to, oh yeah, go talk to that person. I don't want to talk to that person. You know, I might actually have to say something. So I think that chefs in particular, front of the house have a better ability because they just do. That's why chefs hide behind stoves.
Yes. That's why, you know, I did it initially.
You're safe back there.
Yes.
You know, you have fire. So that prevents some people from getting to you. You know,
knives.
Everybody's intimidated by ovens and grills and knives, and chefs look, you know, they look important with it, all this, you know, regalia that chefs wear. So it's a good place. It is a really good place to hide. And I remember when Paul Bocuse said something about, you know, what did you do if there was a journalist that you just didn't want in the kitchen anymore? He said, I took a handful of black peppercorns and threw it on top of the plancha. And 5 minutes later, that person's out of there.
Genius.
I love that technique.
So, but anyway, so thank you. It's really been a remarkable run. And here's the other oddity about February is that I opened Jams in 1984 in February. And so it's not continuous. I closed it in 1990 and reopened in 14. So I can't really call it 40 years, but it's been 40 years since Jams opened.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And in February. So who knew that February was going to be, well, my daughter was born in February, so maybe that has something to do with it.
It's a good month.
Yeah, she's going to be 27 tomorrow.
So wow, congratulations.
Crazy, right?
Honestly, I'm going to say this, and this is not, again, just me flattering you. I thought you were 60 years old.
But he's got the body of a 54-year-old guy.
But of course you couldn't be because of your, I mean, the history of your career, of what you did. And I like the fact that I'm representing New York. Dan's kind of representing L.A., California vibes.
And gave it away.
A little bit of everything that you're about, you know, that you brought that West Coast vibe, love, feeling, farm to table, you know, here to the city the way you fell in love with it in California. And honestly, everybody, I think, who ever did any, I hate to say it, farm to table stuff has you to thank. On the East Coast here, in New York.
It's such a challenge. Look, you think about, I was working in restaurants in New York and all the chefs were like, you got to go to California because it's where the ingredients are. And then you think, you know, the challenge of making food in New York is not getting great ingredients. But I guess you're able to source or was it the timing of, you know, transportation that allowed the ingredients to come back east so that you can kind of make simple food without having a...
It's complicated. The reason I came to New York initially was I originally, before I moved to Los Angeles to work at Michael's, I wanted to come and work in Lutèce.
Oh, wow.
I was working in Chez Panisse, and I said, you know, there's only really one other place I want to go to right now is Lutèce. And I had met Andre, and he didn't really know me, but I had small contact with him. But I knew Pierre Frenet and Craig Claiborne a little bit, and so I figured, well, maybe I can, you know, they'll push me along a little bit. But I took a stab at Los Angeles. I drove down to Los Angeles from San Francisco, and I ran into this guy, Ken Frank, who had just finished working at this restaurant, I kid you not, called La Guillotine. And he was all of 21 or 22 years old, and he was... much more mature than his years and very sort of regal and poised and confident. He said, well, this guy, Michael McCarty, is opening a restaurant in Santa Monica. You should go talk to him. And so I drove out and met Michael and talked to him for like 4 hours. And the back of his, where now the garden was just a big pit in the backyard. And we talked about things and, you know, we shook hands. I became the sous chef for Ken Frank at Michael's, and this is 1978, and
it's still there.
So we opened in 79, not in February.
Was always in same place in Santa Monica. It's always been there?
Always been there. Wow. Always been there. So I was there for 5 years, and along the way that Michael, who was from New York originally, I think he grew up in Rochester, someplace like that. Really wanted to open a restaurant of Michael's in New York. And I said, let's do it together. So he said, yes. So he started looking in places, and he actually found this space on 55th Street, where it is now. And this is 1981, I think. And wow. Michael's was, you know, huge at that point, and, you know, things were going crazy. And I said, I really wanted to come to New York and open Michael's. And so he said, let's do it. And he couldn't make the deal for the lease. Something happened. And, but I was sort of smitten with New York.
Yeah.
It was right at the point now that, you know, that chefs were opening their own restaurants in New York. Leslie Revston had a restaurant called Restaurant Leslie on Carmine Street. You know, she was a real pioneer. Mm. There was Dodin Buffon. There was other people that were starting to open up their own place. You know, Quilted Giraffe.
Yes.
You know, with Barry Wine.
Barry Wine.
Was, you know, he was a real, he had moved down from the Hudson Valley down to New York to open Quilted Giraffe. And that was a huge success. I think he did that in 1980 or 81. So anyway, I saw there was this vibe of, you know, of chefs opening their own restaurants. And that really that didn't really occur before in America. You had European people that would come over and open restaurants and other, but you didn't have Americans or young Americans or whatever opening restaurants as a chef-driven restaurant. Mm-hmm. That really wasn't a thing. That was kind of a shift, a paradigm shift in American cooking. So I really wanted to come to New York, and I had a friend, a guy named Melvin Master, who was at that point the sales manager for Jordan Winery. I had done the opening at Jordan Winery in 1980 or 81, and Melvin goes, "My wife and I are going to open a restaurant in New York. We're going to open a fish restaurant in the Village, and we want you to be the chef." I said, "Well, let's talk about it." So we went and had lunch at the Four Seasons. Power lunch that lasted for hours and hours. We shook hands, and I went back to New York and back to LA and told Michael that I was leaving. And at that point, I had bought this Ferrari, and the Ferrari was in London. I know it's too crazy. And I had an English girlfriend. Her name was Sally. Her name was Sally Clark, and Sally wanted me to move to London.
Oh, wow.
And open a restaurant with her. I was thinking about that, and I had a lot of things on my mind.
Lives it could have been. You know?
Yes, yeah. I'm just going to say for everyone, I'm glad you didn't move to London.
But your Ferrari, the steering wheel was on the left side.
It was a left-hand drive car, but... That's a whole story. Anyway, Melvin and I sort of shook hands, and we spent from February to, I think, August or September running around New York trying to find a space. We had a space in the Village, which is, it's still there. I can't remember what it's called, but it was on.
This is still the early 80s.
Yeah, this is 1983. On an angle, I can't remember the name of the restaurant now, but it's right on Hudson Street. And I just didn't like the space. And Melvin and I we shared an apartment right next to this restaurant called Le Zoo, which then turned into April Bloomfield's restaurant.
Ah, Spotted Pig.
Spotted Pig.
Anyway, so we looked around, couldn't find a space that we liked. And one day, Melvin had this house in Connecticut. We were driving over. There's a famous, it's not there anymore, this famous fish purveyor called Rosedale, which was on Lexington, just off 79th Street. Stopped at Rosedale and to buy fish. And as we parked the car, I noticed a little sign in this window, restaurant for rent on 79th Street. And I said, "I don't want to call. I was too chicken." I said, "Melvin, you call."
Melvin, do it.
Yeah, because he's the erudite, suave English, sort of almost, aristocratic fellow. And so he said, "Okay, fine, I'll call him." And that became the first Jams.
Wow.
79th and
between 3rd and Lex. Closer, it's called Candle 79.
Oh, my God. I grew up on 83rd Street and First Candle 70.
That was the original Jams. So anyway, I opened that restaurant in 1984, in February, 40 years ago.
Wow.
I can't believe I worked in the original Jams.
You did. You didn't even know it.
Candle Cafe.
Yeah, it turned into a vegan restaurant. It was called Trois Jeans for a while. Uh-huh. These three French guys owned it. I haven't been back. It's kind of new.
But I don't believe that Candle 79 is open any longer.
Is it closed?
I don't know. I worked at the original Candle Cafe in like
really?
When I was
in 15. Any case, so I, yes. Yeah, I opened up in New York. And ironically enough, Michael went back to the same space he was looking at originally.
On 55th.
And he opened Michael's there in 1989 or 88. Isn't that...
It's amazing.
The irony of that is so crazy.
It is.
You think about it. But at that point, when I opened up, Ann Rosenzweig was opening up her restaurant. And I was thinking about the other day, the restaurateurs that I miss, chefs. And I miss tremendously. I just loved her style. She was, you know, she was very serious and very sort of professional and
yes.
and very sort of, you know.
She was stern.
Well, I don't think she was so stern. I think she was committed, I would
yes.
say.
Yes, okay.
And, but she had a good sense of humor when if you got to know her pretty well. But she also was just meticulous in her way she operated mm-hmm. in every way, shape, and form. And then Larry Forgione had left the River Cafe, and he opened his restaurant on Lexington. And he and I became like brothers.
Yeah.
Because we were six blocks apart. He would either come down uptown to my restaurant, I would go downtown to his restaurant, six blocks every day.
Every day.
Every day.
Wow. Would you have coffee?
And so going back to the farm-to-table thing, Larry really was my source for farm-to-table.
Ah, that makes so much sense.
So Larry had funded this guy named Paul Kaiser, who is a biochemist who wanted to raise chickens. So Larry had given him $10,000 to grow a breast-style chicken,
mm-hmm.
and that's where my chickens came from.
Is that does that farm, that lineage of chickens, is that still around now, or
has it not evolved? To that extent? Paul was maniacal in terms of his you know lineage to growing
got it. The
really
breasts.
heritage chickens that of to a mature size, and they were like weighed like 4 pounds and stuff.
Wow!
They cost $10 a piece in 1984.
Wow.
That was a lot of money.
That's a lot of money for a chicken.
And I remember when I was, you know, I was
doing. You had a $50 menu item. And
well, you know, so I don't have a menu in front of me, but I'm trying to remember what I charged for chicken. I think it was like $19 or $20. I had Danny Kaye, famous Danny Kaye,
yeah.
came for a preview dinner. And I said, and Danny and I were friends. And I said, Danny, you know, I want to charge this much for chicken. He doesn't skip a beat. He goes, rents are high in New York. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Ah, I love
there
that.
You go.
And, you know, that it was that kind of chutzpah, that kind of, you know, yes. sort of, you know, New Yorker's sort of, you know, response to my, you know, my worry was fantastic. So that just gave me the gumption to be able to do it. And then Andre Soldner was my... He's my mentor.
Was that your first? Sorry. Just because of the chicken, it becomes such a thing. You know, it's like Jonathan Weissman's the chicken guy. it's a rude thing to say, but it's true. Was that the first like iteration of this iconic dish that you're kind of associated with?
Yeah, it really was. It was, you know, this is a weird story, but when we opened up Jams originally, it wasn't really finished, and I had become friendly with Gail Green. Through a guy named Harley Baldwin, who's no longer with us. And she, of course, has died last year. Anyway, so Gail had just started Meals on Wheels.
Oh, wow.
And so she asked me if I wouldn't mind doing the opening of Jams as a, you know, a charity event mm-hmm. for Meals on Wheels. So it was the first time anybody had sort of done that.
Right.
And it was a huge snowstorm that week. And my Vulcan Ranges were stuck in Baltimore. They couldn't get on the freeway. So I opened up
Vulcan Rangers. Your stoves got stuck.
They were stuck in the snow, and so I opened up with two Weber grills.
Oh man.
Wow.
That's what I cooked on.
That's amazing.
So everybody loved the dinners, but some of the women could, you know, my hair smelled like mesquite for like 3 weeks. But it was a great time. And Andre was, you know, he had this Rolodex. And he go, you know, you want, you know, where do you get sea urchins? Where do you get rabbit? Where do you get foie gras? He knew he had every source in his back pocket. So he just opened up he didn't have to do that. He really didn't have to.
Is that just the like, this hospitality you just share?
It was a small community back then.
It still is, though. It still feel like I can call people up. And I moved to L.A. and I called guys up and they just said, here's my accountant, here's my bookkeeper, here's my purveyors.
I think it's our industry. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't understand our industry from a customer point of view because they think that we're all sort of competitive and, you know, you see these shows and, you know, we're sort of a little more gladiator style of – You listen, Amanda, you love doing that. I know you do.
I know. I'm retiring from that.
You're a glutton for punishment. And I think they have their place, and I think they're fun and all that stuff. But true to form, I think chefs are very collaborative, and they're altruistic. I think chefs have a lot of empathy, and I think chefs, you know, really care about feeding people.
Yep.
So when you care about feeding people, I think that's where the empathy comes in. I think that you can't help but, you know, want to feed people in the best way possible, and you don't want to limit that informational pipeline. That pipeline really has to be open to everybody. Remember the Union Square Market wasn't there then. It was back, you know, we had, you know, we did go get fish down on the seaport. That was hysterical and crazy and weird and bizarre.
Describe that scene for
me. Oh, guys, you go there at 4 a.m. and you have guys drinking espresso and a cigarette in the side of the mouth and screaming at you, don't touch the fish. Don't touch that fish.
This is at the Fulton South Street Seaport.
Where the Tin Building is right now. That's where
it always still smells like fish.
It's indelible. But Larry also had cultivated these foragers. So he had someone that would go forage for, you know, wild mushrooms and clover and all these different things. So Larry really was an incredible pioneer in that respect in New York. Listen, within a 100-mile radius of New York City, there's some of the greatest farming in the world. It just didn't... Here's what really happened, was that if you had an Italian restaurant or French restaurant in New York City, you were calcified in terms of your menu. Everybody had asparagus all year round.
Right.
Everybody had raspberry souffle all year round. Everybody had, you know... And there was some regional stuff that would dip into people's menus. You know, you go to some Italian restaurants, they would start bringing white truffles in. You know, you go to like Four Seasons, Seppi Rangeli was another person that really sought out the small farmers and the fishermen and people like that. There was some real pioneers in that respect. And I stole as much information from them as possible to get great ingredients. You know, and then, you know, people would show up my doorstep with crazy stuff. Now, when I was in California...
People are like bringing like a crate of mushrooms to your restaurant? Or...
Well, here's the weird thing. So talk about how life
comes full circle.
Is strange. When I was a chef at Michael's, this guy arrived at my back door with a crate of fish. He goes, I'm from New York and I got the best fish in the world. And it was Joe Guerrero from Citarella.
Oh my God.
This is 1980. And at that point, you couldn't get really good fish in Los Angeles. It didn't exist. All the fishermen, all the fishing boats had basically stopped fishing.
To this day, the East Coast has better fish. It's got more fish. I mean, you've got a few great fish in California.
There wasn't the availability. Yeah. And he goes, he opened this box up, and inside the box was striped bass and Maine sea scallops and, you know, swordfish, you know, a quarter, you know, all this stuff that, you know, that we're used to now. And I looked at the guy and said, sure, give me everything. And so once a week for the next 2 years, he flew out and brought me a package.
Flew from New York
with this, yeah.
To
isn't that crazy?
San Francisco. That's
amazing. No, to Michael's.
To Michael's in LA.
Santa Monica.
Wow,
isn't that wild? But then what happened at Michael's is that people started bringing stuff to my back door. Like one day, these two Australian dudes show up at the back door. And we got a box. Same thing. And they got a crate. So I said, "What's in the crate?" He says, "Well, open it up and look." And there were this most beautiful John Dory you've ever seen from New Zealand.
Wow.
They were extraordinary. I mean, in France, I love John Dory.
Right.
I think it's the greatest fish.
St. Peter. Picked it out of the water, for Christ's sake.
And all of a sudden, these guys, yeah, we're pilots for Qantas, and we'll bring it to you like once every 2 weeks.
Their
side hustle? It was their side hustle.
Oh, that was their side.
I love that.
And then I had this this Algerian guy one day, the same thing, brings me a little, you know, container, and there's live Santa Barbara shrimp in there.
Oh.
And those, I didn't even know that stuff existed. And then I would have people in Mexico grow arico vera for me. And I had this one guy was, it. So.
Wait, do you think,
sorry.
It's so exciting to me to talk about this, because do you think that's the Alice Waters effect? I mean, you worked with her. That's what people used to do. to, you know, they would bring her things all the time.
100%.
And now they're bringing you things. Did they know?
Part of my time at Chez Panisse, I went foraging. I would go up to.
So is that how you met? I mean, these people just magnetized to you. They're coming to your back door.
I think what happened was the people were looking for an outlet to make money.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't a revolution. It wasn't a movement. It was, you know, it was just connecting the dots between, you know, the growers and the end user.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't farm to table.
Right.
I mean, what else is going to be? I mean, I'm sorry. We're not like a Star Trek where you hit a button in a synthesizer and create, you know, you get a steak and French fries. Yes. That's not the way it worked.
These poor guys are knocking on doors with a crate of fish, and you were just the one guy that said,
"Yes,
I can do something with
it." And
this.
They knew they had something special.
Yeah.
You know. But you got it so it was absolutely fresh and perfect.
Yes.
You know, it was literally out of the water, or, you know, from the garden. I remember once sitting at Chez Panisse, and Alice says, "Come over here." And she just shoves this thing in my mouth. And it was this apricot from what is now Silicon Valley. Mm. And so back in the 60s and 70s, you know, Silicon Valley had the greatest apricots in California. Who knew? So, you know, the journey of being a chef is not about cooking, really.
No.
It's about sourcing material.
It is.
Yeah. I think that's really the key that when I was a Chez Panisse, that's what Alice brought to everybody, was that part of it was integrity. Part of it was research, because she had a cookbook collection like no others. Part of it was, you know, sort of looking at the history of food, you know, how it evolved, and, you know, how Catherine de' Medici brought Italian sensibility to Paris when she got married to Henri IV, Henri V, whatever he was. So all these different things that had happened over the years, Alice was very studious about things.
Yeah, so she was a historian in a way.
She was more than a historian. I think she was, you know, she's amazing.
Right. Well, so there's this romantic vision in my head of Alice sort of sweaty and shiny, and she has an apricot in her hand and it's juicy and she places it in your mouth. There's something very sexy about that.
You know, well, Alice was an amazing, I mean, she started off as a Montessori school teacher.
Yes.
So she obviously was about nurturing and about
holistic learning
and all that stuff. And she took that philosophy and embedded it in her restaurant. And I think that's a huge part of why she is so successful and so...
There's
very few people that I've ever would call a genius. I would say Alice is a genius.
Yeah, and it's hard not to be in love with her, enamored by her. You know, just everybody who's ever had a passion for an ingredient or ever discovered an ingredient, any chef anyway, or anybody who's interested in food. I mean, I think it just, in a way, we have to thank her. And I got to cook in that kitchen once, and I was in awe of how they did everything.
Yeah, I mean, you have to realize that, you know, this was a woman that didn't have any culinary training. She basically learned, you know, to cook from cookbooks and by going and visiting people. And but what she was very smart about was hiring amazing people. And one of the most amazing cooks that she hired was this guy named Jean-Pierre Moulet. And Jean-Pierre, I was lucky to work with and became friends with. And Jean-Pierre was the consummate French chef. He knew, his vocabulary was gigantic. Mm. And he had all the skill sets. I never worked with anybody that has skill technically, and sort of, he had that, you know, sort of that magic touch in the kitchen. And he just loved it. And he really was the backbone for many years. He was almost there for 35 years,
yeah,
Jean-Pierre.
He was there for a long time.
And, you know, he really established Chez Panisse on a professional level that, you know, that's really kept it going.
Yep.
And created this sort of system there, which is unlike any other restaurant in the world. And because the menu doesn't repeat itself.
Never.
Isn't that crazy?
Never repeats itself.
That's a crazy thing. You think about it. And I mean, listen, there's... similarities in different dishes and things like that. But I don't know what the math is on how many dishes that Chablis has produced since 1971. You know, it's mind-boggling that Alice sort of has her finger on every one of those menus.
It's fascinating.
And it's hard to really comprehend, you know, that what she has accomplished.
Yeah, and you said something there about Jean-Pierre and him bringing like a professional level to it. I think it's really hard to separate the artist and the business person as well. You know, we talk about restaurants now. We talk so much about the nitty-gritty and the business of it because you end up you're so good at your craft, right? You don't have to prove that you can cook a chicken or source an ingredient anymore. It's more now about how you keep it going, how you run it.
But also, like, it's just so expensive and cumbersome that there's like no room for creativity in these. You gotta go to maybe in the tertiary markets you could still.
But when you put a bunch of chefs together, I mean, we want to talk about the apricot moment. We want to talk about how somebody who had a side hustle, who probably never knew how to cook a John Dory in their life, they were just bringing it to you. You know, that we just want to talk about that. You know, we want to get back.
Yeah, I think that it's the thing that the hardest thing I struggled with from Chablis, I still struggle with it, is understanding seasonality and being true to that, knowing when things are going to be available. Like, for instance, in California, asparagus starts in February and goes all the way through July sometimes.
Depends in New York, you get like 3 minutes of
asparagus. You get 2 seconds. I remember the first time somebody brought me asparagus from Long Island. I go, oh, my God, this is amazing. He says, good luck, buddy.
Next year, I'll be back.
Next week, you're not going to have
cherries are my
favorite. Don't put it on the menu.
You know, like those apricots from the Finger Lakes or... You know, it's really crazy. What it did was it forced my philosophical tuning fork to try to be attentive to those things always.
Yeah.
And not try to push the envelope. And, you know, I remember, you know, hearing stories in Japan, you know, that the emperor, you know, always had the first melon of the season. Mm-hmm. And someone would, you know... That somebody, some garden, and they said, this melon's going to be for the emperor. I'm going to bring it to him myself. And there is a little bit of that sort of magical, you know, ability to create this perfect melon for the emperor. And I think that's what Alice really would say. That's the key here.
Yes.
That you want to have the perfect rice or the perfect squab or the most beautiful piece of lettuce that you've ever seen in your life. I remember one time, that's actually on my honeymoon.
Where did you honeymoon?
All over France and Italy. And we were in the south of France in Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat, and we went to this little hotel, which is still there. And we were traveling, and we didn't stop for lunch. And so we got to our room, and it's like 2:30, and of course lunch, they weren't serving lunch anymore. So we went down by the pool. And the guy said, well, if you want to have a snack, I'll bring you something. And what he brought us was some grilled toast with some goat cheese and a mezcal salad.
Oh, my God.
And when I ate the mezcal salad,
That's the 80s on a plate.
And it was olive oil and salt, nothing else. And I go, you know what? That's it. That's what makes life perfect.
I feel like you talk about they're like photographers, and they're like, they always retire as a landscape photographer. You know, it's like they finally got to a place where they're confident enough to just take in the beauty and share it. Like, do you feel like, is Italian food that for you, that you found your evolution to there, or is there some next and final stage of something you want to present? Are you just going to be
offering? Well, when I opened Barbuto, the story is kind of cute. I had a restaurant called Washington Park.
I remember that.
And it wasn't going to work out. It's the economics.
Stars didn't
the economics.
Align.
The economics of this stuff and partnerships, but that's for another time. Anyway, we live in the Upper West Side, and we have the top apartment. But there's a penthouse house that was built on top of the building about 40 years ago. And the architects have built it lived there until about, I don't know, 2001. About 2001. And then they sold it to this Italian couple. And when they moved in 2002, I think, or 2003, Sally, my wife, says, you know, I think they just moved in. It's Christmas Eve. I'm sure they don't have anything to eat. Let's invite them down for snacks. And so we invited them down to have, you know, blinis and caviar and some champagne. And it was a very tall Italian dude with a funky beard and crazy Italian clothes, and his tiny wife, who was about 5'2". And his English was okay. Hers was impeccable. And my wife, after doing this, says, "What kind of stupid? It's Alessandra Ferri, who's the most famous ballerina in the world." And she was at that point. She was at the pinnacle of her career, and she was just so modest and sweet and like, okay. So
I love that naivete, though. I mean, you would never.
A week later, she calls up. You know, we're doubly stupid. It's her husband is the greatest fashion photographer in Italy, and Fabrizio Ferri. Now, strange enough, they actually weren't married, but they had the same last name.
Meanwhile, they're like, "Hey, I cannot believe that guy. We just took him for granted, but he's the most famous chef in New York."
And so, Alessandra was dancing in Tokyo and La Scala and Milan. So she was traveling around the world, but Fabrizio had Industria on Washington Street.
Yeah,
and so he kept knocking on my door every time I would cook dinner sometimes, and he was always hungry, so I would feed him dinner. And he became part of the family. And one day he goes, Jonathan, I want you to do a restaurant in my space in Industria. So your friend Jimmy Bradley and I walked up Washington Street, and we get within about a block, and Jimmy goes, "I wouldn't touch that dump with a 10-foot pole."
Wow, Jimmy. Oh, Jimmy.
So I went and looked at it.
At the time, this wasn't like a sought-after, like industrial restaurant neighborhood.
I had lived on Horatio Street in the building that Barbuda's in now in 1983. So I knew that spot very well. And it was still, the meat district was still, there was still meat hanging on the on hooks on
meat,
on
hanging. Meat hanging on hooks and hookers walking on the street.
Exactly. Yeah. And Florent was in
Florent.
And Tortilla Flats. Anyway, so I went to look at the space, and it was just this jumble of weirdness. And it was like somebody put this together with it was a committee of 25 people put this thing together. So Fabrizio, I said, I don't really want to do this. And then I disengaged from Washington Park, and Fabrizio goes, I said, okay, let's just do it. And I said, I'm going to open a typical Jonathan Waxman style restaurant. He goes, no, you're opening an Italian restaurant.
Oh.
I said, I'm a Jew boy from Berkeley. I am not, I'm not an Italian. I don't have that sensibility. And Fabrizio said something really cute and sweet. He goes, you cook like my Roman grandmother. Wow. I said, what are you talking about?
That's a huge compliment.
He goes, you cook very simply and from your heart. So he really buttered me up. So we shook hands and we opened Barbuto. And I spent $125,000 building Barbuto.
Wow.
That's it.
I think anybody who's listening who's not in the restaurant industry needs to know that equates to around $5 compared to what it takes
it
today.
Didn't mean jack shit.
It takes millions of dollars to open a restaurant.
We opened it up. I didn't have a point of sale. I didn't have a manager. It's a true story. I had my chef, Lynn McNeely, who had been my chef at Washington Park, and who is the most adorable person in the world. One of the smartest cooks in the planet, and delightful. And I hired a couple of waiters, and we opened a restaurant. I didn't think anybody would come.
I love that feeling. That where you don't think anybody's going to walk in the door.
No, I didn't think anybody would come. I didn't. We didn't have a point of sale. I did everything old fashioned with using
the dew pads,
and the whole thing. And at one point,
just cash. I mean, did you have credit card?
I don't know. I can't remember how he did it.
Checks.
And
write a check.
So one of my waiters, Chris Stein, lovely Chris Stein, who was a drummer on the side, says, Waxman, I think we need a manager. I said, really? He goes, yeah, I think so. I said, okay. So I talked to another friend of mine, chef. He says, yeah, my wife's looking for a job. She's a restaurant manager. I said, well, send her in. So this woman shows up. Tall, beautiful, blonde, had a degree, a law degree. It's like, okay, fine, you're hired, lady.
Overqualified,
but we were desperate. So the first night, Chris comes in the kitchen and goes, Chef, I don't know what to say, but our new manager's in the bathroom screaming and throwing water in her face. I said, that doesn't sound good. And so we sort of, I finally found someone who was stable to come in and help run the restaurant.
She was
and
unstable.
I was still being so cheap because I parsed together this stupid point of sale from this dubious computer company in somewhere, and it was the worst point of sale system on the planet. And
micros, maybe.
But all we cared about, Alden and I cared about, was making good food.
I feel like,
and that's an amazing start.
Honestly, it's still all of the technology. It all still gets in the way. It really is like a pen and paper and a fire is all you really need.
And that was part of my philosophy at Jams. I didn't allow any robo-coups. Everything had to be chopped by hand. I didn't even have a deep fryer. I just had a pot of oil, which somebody dumped on my back one night.
Oh Jesus.
That wasn't fun.
I mean, it's like a hospital trip, not fun.
No, but, it's funny. Because Lynn had lived and worked in Rome, he had the vocabulary. Mm. And so he was able to sort of articulate what we should be doing. And also, I was really obnoxious. And I had nothing on the menu more than $19. And I just sort of seemed to piss everybody off, but I didn't really care.
Well, did you make money? Yeah. I mean, it work?
Well, we're still here.
Yeah.
So
I had to sell the Ferrari, but
I actually did sell the Ferrari. That's a whole nother story.
Wait, so but then you're brave, you're bold, you've got a lot of chutzpah and youthful
moxie,
bravado at this, and you're saying, okay, I'm going to cook Italian food. But Lynn is sort of guiding you.
Lynn was an incredibly, I'll tell you a funny story about Lynn. Oh. So I first met Lynn, and he was working at this restaurant, I kid you not, called Alex Goes to Camp.
What?
That was the name of the restaurant on 3rd Avenue. And he comes over one day, and Lynn must have been at like 20 or 21 years old. This is 1980. And he goes, Chef, I don't know how to turn on the exhaust fan in the kitchen. So I say, okay, Lynn, let's go figure this out. Because, people had, switches in weird spots.
Sure.
So we figured out how to turn it on. And we became instant friends.
Yes.
Isn't that great?
I think there's a connection when you say you don't know how to do something. When you can trust somebody enough to say, I don't know how to do this.
Well, or just smart enough to realize that I got to get open, so what am I going to do? So Lynn and I became instant friends from that moment on. And the thing about Lynn that I really loved was that he was incredibly intellectual, but at the same time very sensual in terms of how he touched food.
Yes.
And that's a gift. You can't learn it. I think you just it's there.
Yeah, that's a
natural.
I don't
know if you guys agree with this, but I think there's some instinctual or sort of God-given, talent that no matter if you don't have it, you're not going to get it.
Yep.
You can get parts of that puzzle, but it's like baseball. It's hard to make a double play. And I think only very few people know how to make a great double play. I think cooking is the same thing.
Cooking is the same.
And I think, and that's, I was thinking about, when I had a restaurant in Napa Valley in 1991 called Table 29, and I had the line. This is funny. I had myself and a sous chef and a garde manger and a pastry chef. We would do 500 covers a night. Mm. 500 covers, because we were just like in sync.
Wow.
You know, we just.
That is like.
We were in sync.
A symphony. We were talking about how kitchen.
It's more
expedited.
more like a tight rock and roll band.
Yes.
You know, that you get on stage and everybody, no, you don't have to even look at each other.
Yeah.
That state of flow when you work with people and it feels so easy.
Seamless.
Yeah. And that's what Barbuda was like from the very beginning. And, you know, I brought people in, or people showed up at the back door that wanted to work. And
people, product, yeah. Shows up at the back door, you know, always.
And, you know, and there was friends of friends. And, people would just call me and say, look, I got this guy. He's been with me for 4 years. It's time for a change.
Right.
You know? Or, you know, I remember... people show up, but the funniest thing was when I first opened Washington Park, I was hiring people, and this woman walks in, and she said, are you hiring people? I said, yeah, I am. She said, well, I want to apply for a pastry position. I said, okay, fine. So I look at her resume, and I read it, and she's sort of standing there looking at me. And I said, do you mind if I call up your old boss? And she goes, sure. So I call up, it was a friend of mine from Boston. And I said, what about her? And she goes, you'd be an idiot not to hire her.
Oh, I love those moments.
You know, it's like.
Who was it?
Who
was the pastry chef? No kiss, no tell. No pastry
Well, so
chef.
She's been with me since 2001, Heather Miller.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
You know, she went to work for Mark and Vicky at Cook Shop for a little bit. But. She's either worked at Jams, Washington Park, or Barbuda since 2001.
Eaten her product. It's amazing.
She's amazing.
So just think about the amount of people who have come through your kitchen and gone back out into the culinary world and sort of that lineage, that family tree. I mean, who is there any chef particular that's gone out that you feel like is it not? I'm not going to say a favorite. But one of your go-tos.
There's a lot of them. You know, Eric Bromberg from Blue Ribbon.
Yes.
You know.
He created quite a vibe.
You know, he didn't understand me at all. The first time, this is a funny story.
I
funny
love
story.
That.
And, you know, Eric describes it. He's so funny when he speaks. He really thinks before he talks. He doesn't. Do what I do, just bullshit. And I was doing Meals on Wheels in Rockefeller Center, and I had this stupid idea that year to do whole foie gras grilled.
at an event?
At an event. And,
wow.
And, I've never seen a whole foie gras grilled.
Yeah.
A whole lobe,
just
a whole liver.
Or something like that?
The
smoke, fat out?
The smoke.
It's just a piece of fat.
The smoke was like this dark plume. Going up to the rainbow room.
It's a grilled piece of fat.
So Eric and Bruce Bromberg were the grill cooks that day.
Oh, wow.
That evening. And Bobby Flay was on the line with me. Oh, there's another funny story about that night. So Bobby's sitting next to me slicing the foie gras and putting it.
He working for you at that point?
Yeah, he's working for me. And so he's putting it on these little crouton things. I think a cherry salsa with habaneros and stuff. And Bobby looks over and goes, see that woman over there? I said, yeah. She says, I'm going to marry her. It was Deborah Ponczak.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that weird?
Deborah Ponczak, very famous chef who ran Montrachet for Drew Nearpont.
And, Bobby.
Were they married? Or?
They got married. I said, Bobby. You know, that says a lot about Bobby.
Oh,
right
yeah.
There,
he's
you know?
He's very sure of himself.
And it was, Bobby worked for me for a long time. You know,
that makes sense.
At Buds.
He's another man who's very, very free with his with sharing and is very generous. Maybe you've offered that to people as well, giving them the confidence.
I learned it from other people and, you know, you pass it down. I think, you know, you I think... Every time I hear about a chef saying that my recipe is secret, I said, well, you're just a fool.
Yeah.
Nothing's, number one, nothing's secret. Nothing's sacred.
Nothing's ever been secret.
And you think so, the times change so quickly now that your secret is going to be stale in 2 years.
The other thing I
forgot
is like you can making a great roast chicken once, God bless you. Come back in 20 years if you're still making it great and consistently. That's the secret. The secret and, is the discipline.
You know, that's the thing, too, that what people just don't get. to cook a chicken properly, every chicken's different. Your mood affects everything. You know, the vibe in the restaurant affects things. You know, if I'm in a bad mood, I know I'm not going to make great food that day.
I've been there. I've felt that.
It's like this, those Japanese, you know, like you see the Japanese documentary, and the guy's like, you know, he just can't get any good help these days. They all want to move up. The guy's been with me for 12 years, and he already wants to move to the next station.
Well, but when you were talking about the 80s and learning about seasonality, I just want to go back to that really quickly because it stuck with me. Because of my love for California produce, of course, we always have envy here in New York. But when I started working for Diane Forley, who had Verbena in 1994, I stayed with her for 6 years. And in the beginning, prior to that, I'd worked for mostly French chefs. And the goal then was, as a French chef in New York, you get anything from anywhere. You get raspberries from Chile because that was the flex, right? That I can get my raspberries from Chile. And then when I started working for her, I didn't understand the flow of the seasons. And we had the best era. We were right near Union Square Green Market. We were connecting with chefs and farmers every time we walked over there. And my relationship with the farmers was probably one of the most important thing that I ever learned and continue to keep. But the seasonality, like Diane had this naturalness. She knew, you know, we were using squash and potatoes and all these winter vegetables, and then the asparagus came. And, you know, I love the dish we made with asparagus, and we had to change it because here comes, you know, some of the summer stuff. And I got so attached, you know, to everything. And it just taught me how to move and flow and be more creative to be able to release that thing that you love, you know. And here comes the season. You're forced. And we were never taught that, and I learned so much from that.
Well, and Diane's another chef that I really miss from New York.
Yes, me too.
And she was, my wife will say it's her favorite restaurant ever. And I think that, you know, that seasonality thing, I love change.
Yes.
A lot of people don't like change.
Yep.
A lot of people are really uncomfortable with change. But the seasons change all the time, and every season is different. You know, I got chanterelles last week. They're amazing. Well, not going to get chanterelles for 3 weeks now because of the rains in the West. And you have to prepare for that. And, you know, so we change the menu, not drastically, but we change it every day.
Yeah.
And to sort of follow along what's in the green market, my sort of crazy whims my tangents I go on to. And luckily, like with Heather, every once in a while she goes, Chef, let's sit down and talk about ingredients. Because I need stimulation. I need to know what you're thinking about in your head.
Right.
So I send her pictures all the time and stuff.
Is that, I was going to say, how do you keep everybody inspired?
I send her pictures and she loves it. And she goes, and she just gets inspired by the pictures and she's not copying them. What it does is that it's triggering something in her culinary sensibilities about, you know, like she was doing these, like for the last 3 months, these mini tart tatins. They're this big.
Ugh.
It was pure genius. And the way she was doing it, I watched her do it and it's like,
wow,
that's so logical, so smart. And they were perfect little tart tatins. Mm. But isn't that great?
I want to pop one of those in my mouth right now.
Yeah. I mean, they were just remarkable. I go, you know.
That takes skill, though.
It takes skill, but it also takes a sense of the seasons and knowing that the apples are really good for this right now. They make sense right now.
You have this core group of amazing people. And then I know the industry is hard and there's some apathy that comes with not being able to find staff to keep it going, to see the changes, to see the rents or whatever. Do you have hope for this industry for the future? I mean, that's really my question. And we could talk for 17 hours about social media and influencers and people who aren't chefs. One of the things that Mark Forgione said when he was in here was not just, but being a chef of a restaurant is good enough. He was trying to put that message out there that you don't have to be 5,000 other things. That is all we ever wanted when I started my career. That was all I ever wanted to do. Now the pressure of being everything else is there. But do you feel like there's a little bit of hope for the beauty of what you experienced through your career?
He's got a grimace on his face.
No, it's not a grimace. I'm sort of thinking hard. I don't want to step on my own toes here. But what I will say is that, listen, the food industry is the second biggest employer in the United States. Okay? There's a lot of power there. But we're very disorganized from the top to bottom and on a horizontal level. We're very discombobulated as a group. That's number one. Number two is that sometimes we don't throw a wide enough demographic net to mm-hmm. capture people. And I think a lot of the trials of things, the bad things that have happened in the last 10 years, some of the bad press and some of the notions of, chefs as being arrogant or whatever, it's sometimes it becomes indelible on you. It's hard to eradicate mm-hmm. that sort of philosophy. I think what I'm encouraged by is two things. One is the international community that's come to America and opened our eyes to all these different cuisines.
Yes.
I think that is remarkable. Immigrants, sorry, but immigrants are super important, and I think they're the future.
Oh, I love that.
That's number one. Number two is that I think that a lot of people look at kitchens as hot, dirty, hard places, and really they don't have to be.
Mm.
They don't have, you could have a vegan restaurant and not have
any fire
at all.
Yeah.
You could have a seafood restaurant and just do raw seafood. There's lots of ways to make it work. Aaron Sanchez and I always talk about having a restaurant on the beach in Veracruz and going, it's always siempre cerrado, we're always closed. And, it only open when you want to be. But I think there's a lot of ways to make, restaurants work.
Well, when you say a restaurant kitchen is hot and dirty and all these things, when you say that, I luckily still think of a restaurant kitchen as a family.
I think that's the important point that it really isn't like you walk into Barbudo. We were hiring a new chef, sous chef, and he came over. He says halfway through, he goes, "Chef, this is fun."
Yeah.
And if you can create an environment where somebody walks in the kitchen that's never worked in your kitchen, and he said, "This is fun," then you're on the right track.
That's right.
You're doing something correctly, and I think too that there's nothing wrong with hard work.
No,
there's nothing wrong with heat. There's nothing wrong with intensity of service. It's not for everybody. And that's fine.
That's fine.
That's cool. But I think some people that don't know they have the talent, it's our job to kind of extract the passion from them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the clue, is to look at people and say, I love asking people, what are you going to be when you grow up? whether they're 20 or 60, what are you going to be when you grow up? Because I want people to try to look and see what their aspirations are.
Jonathan, what are you going to be when you grow up?
Exactly. A fly fisherman. That's what I want to be. It's crazy.
You and Tom Valenti will go fly fishing.
I love doing it. But I think,
they literally are like, she's coming in.
No, but I mean, I love that everything you do in your life, and then there's more. There's more to do. So we can't thank you enough for doing what you've done for the industry, doing what you've done for chefs like us, also being a kind, generous man to even give us any of your time today. So we're unfortunately going to have to wrap it up. Thank you for being
TBC,
here.
You know,
congratulations on 20 years. We love you.
Thank you.
We love you so much.
You got cut off. They cut you off.
I don't mind being cut off.
They made me do the dirty work.
You know, I'm always, you know, on all these TV shows, I'm always the one doing the dirty work. Always.
Cutting other people off.
I said Bobby Flay, beat Bobby Flay. Yeah. And they made me do all the dirty work.
I know. So
it's like, really?
On the Line was recorded in New York City at Dubway Studios. Thanks, Al. Our studio engineer and editor is Mark Frangelo.
Our theme song is an original composition generously donated and played by Chef John DeLucci.
Our producer is Cindy Augustine, and our co-producer and publicist is Jesse Gerstein.
That's all, folks. Thanks for listening.